Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On May 21st, 1908, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde premiered in Chicago and was America's first silent horror movie. Now in this same year, the topic of this week's story was born. Let's just say there were some similarities between the two, because he was recognized as a silent individual and calm like Dr. Jekyll when you have a conversation. But when you get him and the gridiron are in the ring, he turns full on Mr. Hyde and goes all beast mode. This man, well, it's the perfect football name, of course. It's Bronco Nagurski.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
Great Scott.
This time we step up for the DeLorean. The date is March 11th, 2020. The world was still, well, almost normal. And football was on the air at the Football History Dude podcast. This was the first time that we had Mr. Chris Willis on the podcast for an interview. That was to talk about his time with NFL Films, and also his recently released Red Grange book. Since then, Chris has been a little bit of a busy guy, still working on all sorts of projects at NFL Films, and then the reason for this week's interview, to talk about his new book, Bronco Nagurski, The Legendary Story of the NFL's Greatest Two-Way Fullback. Bronco Nagurski, I gotta imagine, close your eyes, say his name a few times. You're going to wake up in the 30s on the gridiron, a 50-yard line. I mean, come on. Is there a better football name out there? You just say Bronco Nagurski and you think about old-school tough football. And I tell you what, he holds a special place in my heart for this show, that is. I mean, come on. Bronco was episode number 7. Well, even 6 if you don't count the listener episode at the beginning. And back then, even though I had heard the name, I thoroughly enjoyed learning about the legend that is Bronco Nagurski. And we'll get into that more in this interview. But first, again, if you haven't listened to that episode with Chris Willis, yeah, you got to go back and listen to it because you can learn more about him and really his time at NFL Films and kind of how that process works. But here's a little background for you. Chris Willis is the head archivist at NFL Films since 1996. He is the author of 8 books on pro football history, including The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr, and also Red Grange, The Life and Legacy of the NFL's First Superstar. Willis won an Emmy for his work on HBO's Hard Knocks and was a member of the Blue Ribbon panel that selected the NFL's 100th anniversary all-time team back in 2019. So, I'd say not a bad resume for a football historian. And that's just kind of touching the top of it because that's like the highlights. And speaking of a football historian, though, that's been with NFL Films since 1996, if you have a question or feedback for Chris, hey, feel free to reach out to us over on the contact page at the Sports History Network. That's sportshistorynetwork.com/contact. I'll make sure that your questions or comments get right over to Chris so he can answer them for you. But for now, let's get into the interview with Chris Willis. Basically, is there a better way? Could the football gods have given us a better way to talk about a person than the football name Bronco Nagurski?
I'm hard to come up with one that's that ideal, you know. But I say that too a lot, especially since I was doing research on the book. Is he's got the, you know, the perfect name, especially the perfect name for the two-way era, you know, like Bronco Nagurski. He played both offense, defense. You know, he's the perfect fullback. So, nobody could have created that if we're a movie script better than say, hey, let's call him Bronco Nagurski. And you didn't have to make that up.
Yeah. So even going back to my days when I was mostly solo episodes, I had the Nagurski episode back in, I can't remember when, but it was like when I was very beginning in my stages and I had known of the name. I did some research because of that episode, but I was like, man, this guy really did have a lot more depth to him. And like you said, the whole, we'll talk about the two-way and all that type of deal, but let's maybe give you a chance. So like, let's start with a timeline, just a brief, like you mentioned a movie, jump from scene to scene of Bronco's life, maybe from different eras all the way to his major public appearance for the coin toss of Super Bowl 18.
Well, Bronco was actually born in Canada, you know, near Rainier River there near Ontario. So he's technically one of the few Hall of Famers that actually was born outside of the United States. But his family moved to International Falls, Minnesota, right across the river early in his life, and sort of made their home there. And pretty much his entire life, you know, pretty much since he was about 6 or 7 years old, was in International Falls. You know, even when he played with the Bears in Chicago and he was, a world champion wrestler, he would always return to International Falls. You know, he married, you know, a local girl there. He, you know, was married for 50 years. He raised his family there. He went to the University of Minnesota. So he was always pretty much a Minnesota native, you know, his entire life, you know. So, and his background there, you know, sort of helping his father, you know, on the farm, you know, he learned, you know, how to do hard work. He built up his body. You know, if you look at some of the photos and some of his wrestling, I mean, he was a chiseled 6'2", you know, 235, sometimes he would be up to 240, you know. He was just a very large, you know, physically imposing man. And a lot of that was, you know, working on the farms. He worked in the mills there, you know, during some summers, you know, while he was going to University of Minnesota. And he sort of got the reputation of being probably the strongest man, you know, in that region, you know, which was known for Paul Bunyan and, you know, the sort of, you know, larger than life type of, you know, sort of persona, you know. He actually lived it. You know, he was just this big, you know, posing guy who was a, you know, great football player, you know, great wrestler, you know, and it turned out to be sort of a humble, you know, sort of man there, you know, living in International Falls. But his career, like you said, mainly with the research for the book was his career as a, you know, his NFL career with the Chicago Bears. You know, he was an All-American at University of Minnesota. And he played tackle. He played in as a sophomore. He actually played some tackle and then fullback his junior and senior year. And, you know, his senior year, he actually made an All-American team at both tackle and at fullback. You know, the New York Sun actually was the one that put him at the tackle position. Although he did not play tackle all that much during the year, he actually played a lot more fullback, especially in the Big Ten games. And so that attracted, you know, all the pro scouts. And, you know, at the time, remember, there was no draft at the time. So, you know, it was sort of a free-for-all, you know, for some of the teams to recruit. And so, you know, because he made some All-American teams, he was on the radar of some of the, you know, the pro teams, you know, and especially George House with the Chicago Bears. You know, he was able to meet Nagurski at the end of his senior year. There's an all-star game that was called the East-West Shrine Game. It's still going on. It's out West Coast. It was a very popular game, you know, in 1930 at the time, January 1st, 1930, they would play it. Well, they practiced in Chicago the Easter team and before they went out to San Francisco. Well, House was able to meet some of the players and try to, you know, give them his spiel to join the Bears, and Nagurski was at the top of his list. And that's sort of what got the ball rolling, you know, because Bronco wanted to play pro ball. He thought he could maximize, you know, make some money, you know. This is before he started really his professional wrestling career. And so he was intrigued that House would be interested in. And then it was this one thing with the research, because I worked with the family and they had all his contracts, and the contracts would say how much he earned, and it would be this sort of wrestling, and some of the letters from House that the family preserved, there would be this sort of yearly wrestle match between them two of how much they would end up with the salary. Cause he got a really good salary his rookie year in 1930 of $5,000 a year. Well, you got to remember, this is the depression, you know, the stock market crashed, you know, in the end of 1929, and 5,000 was good. Well, the next year House said, well, we got to cut your salary. So each year he's almost cutting his salary, which most people would have actually got a raise, because Nagurski was one of the best players in the league. He wasn't terrible, so he didn't need to take a pay cut. He was actually getting better. So those letters and that research was very fun to go through and see the interpretation that Bronco and George House went through in those years. And so that's, you know, that's sort of how he got to Chicago. And then obviously he had a tremendous career there, you know, with the Bears. We'll probably go a little bit more about his Bears, but, you know, obviously, you know, that career, you know, from 1930 to 1937, you know, he was pretty much an all pro almost every year. And then he sort of went full time into wrestling because he could make more money. He finally got tired of negotiating with Palace and he went wrestling. But then he came back one year in the war in 1943, where he played mainly tackle when they needed extra players. And so that's sort of maybe a little short recap of where he came from, what he did, and you know, the teams he played for, and sort of the standard of his sort of timeline.
So what about the letters with Hal? Were they actually the letters back and forth, or was it just the ones that Hal sent to him?
Well, it was mainly the ones that Hal sent to him, but Hal would sometimes recap what Bronk was saying. You know, in his initial paragraph, he would say, well, I don't understand, Bronk, why you're maybe a little upset with the contract offer. So, you know, he was upset at the contract offer, you know, because Hal is bringing it up. So, but a lot of it was, you know, from Hal's sort of viewpoint and sort of where they eventually got, because in the contracts you could see which figure they finally ended up with and when he signed the contract. You know, a lot of times it was almost right when camp was about to start, so you knew there were some negotiations in the summer to get to where they wanted to.
I see. Yeah, I was wondering if maybe like somehow you're able to obtain the letters from House, if he even would have kept them. But then I wonder if they were, because didn't the Bears have like a major fire or a couple fires in their warehouse a couple times a long time ago?
Yeah, they had a fire. One of the big fires, I believe, was, you know, in the early 50s, that, you know, they lost a lot of their documents and film and things like that. So they've had some things over the years that not quite as good with their storing their history.
Yeah, it gets brought up with Joe Ziemba, because he talks about the various, you know, some of the stuff that might have been lost to history, and you got to really dig deep. And I guess as a researcher, that's really right up your alley, huh?
Sure. You know, you hate hearing those type of stories, you know, whether it's a flood or a basement or a fire. You're like, ah, no, because a lot of that stuff is priceless. You can't find it anywhere else.
So going through all of the research and all that type of stuff to create the book, I mean, we'll get into that. But like, why did you, I mean, if someone asked you elevator pitch, why choose a book dedicated a biography entirely to one individual's life, Bronco Nagurski?
Yeah, I mean, I get that all the time because I've written a few biographies. Well, this one I didn't plan on writing initially. In 2019, I wrote a biography on Red Grange, which was coincided with the NFL's 100th season. You know, he was their first superstar, so I wanted to present his story. Well, through that, I had interviewed Tony Nagurski, who was the oldest son living of Bronco Nagurski. So I interviewed him in Illinois, and we got to know each other a little bit. And then when he read the Grange book, he actually contacted me and say, hey, I liked what you did with Red's story. Is this something you might want to do, you know, for my father's story, you know, and that intrigued me. Like I said, I had known Tony a little bit. So there was a little bit of familiarity and comfortableness with the family. And actually literally 2 weeks before COVID, we actually sat down and talked, you know, we got together again, and he presented some of the material, like I said, with some of the letters and contracts. And we talked about the story and what we thought might happen and what we could do with it. And that's when I got intrigued. I was like, you know what, you know, I wasn't really planning on doing Bronco, you know, as a book, and but to be able to find some unique research and also the interviews, there's actually, he had four other siblings that were living, you know, there were six children that Bronco and Eileen Nikersky had, and Bronco Jr., who actually played in the CFL, he didn't play in the NFL, he played in the CFL. He had passed away, but the other five were living. So you were able to get a lot more insight too. So I think between all of that combined, I was like, you know what, this is something that, you know, could be, you know, an interesting project that's worth value. You know, it's a great story. I mean, you know, Bronco is a very, you know, interesting man, you know, a little bit shy, and he didn't really want the publicity, but, you know, here's a guy who's one of the all time greats, you know, especially in NFL history, you know, so that's how I got to the project.
That's kind of funny too, how sometimes you'll have that, like, just this dominating force of which you don't want to be on the other side, and there's no intimidation factor there, but then just maybe a little just offline outside. I mean, it reminds me of, we talk about Barry Sanders in a different light, but just hand the ball to the ref, walk away kind of deal. It's just, that's kind of cool.
Sure. You know, he was definitely that. He didn't seek the limelight quite as much.
Well, speaking of the limelight, okay, we got to get this out of the way. What's the deal with, you got Red Grange, Bronco Nagurski books back to back, and we're talking about the Lions fan going back to that championship game with that little play, the jump step throw over, and then that turned into the playoffs after it. What's the deal there?
Well, everybody, probably one of the top five all-time greatest games in NFL history, that pretty much nobody knows about, is the 1930 indoor game, you know, 1932 indoor game between the Portsmouth Spartans and the Chicago Bears. They tied for first place in NFL that year, and there was no championship game. It wasn't like the World Series where you had National League, American League, and they would play in the World Series. It was the first time that two teams actually tied. So they end up agreeing to play another game. Hey, we can make more money. This could be, you know, determine the champion. We want to do this. And unfortunately, a snowstorm hit Chicago the week before and the week of the game, and there was just massive snow on the ground. So George Halas and the Harry Snyder was the manager of the Spartans, sort of talked to the NFL president at the time, Joe Carr, to maybe playing it indoors at Chicago Stadium. That's the well-known basketball arena, you know, where the Bulls played and the Blackhawks, you know, would play and stuff like that. Later. And so they agreed to play this game. It was played on an 80-yard field because it was confined. You know, they had to come up with a few rules, you know, like hash marks, which were never used at the time, you know, to bring the ball in away from the floorboards and the running boards. And they actually got a sold out crowd to come because it was indoors. And the Bears actually upset the Portsmouth Spartans, you know, 9-0 on a Nagurski pass to Red Grange, which you had to be, the rules back then, you had to be 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage to throw a pass, and he actually threw a jump pass at some. The Spartan says he was behind the line of scrimmage. The Bears say no, he was, you know, it was legal, but they end up winning 9-0. But it changed pretty much everything about the NFL, you know, not just the rules. It changed, you know, they split into two divisions and we created the NFL championship game. Like all the things we see now is, oh, wow, that's how the history began. And, you know, and they started separating themselves from college football with this game. It all started with that indoor game. And then, which, like I said, you can't even make that up. It's just like Bronco's name. You just can't make up that scene where they played an indoor game, created these rules, and had this funky game with this goofy touchdown. And it just, like I said, it goes, to me, it's one of the top five all-time greatest games. It's especially significant, you know, impactful on the league, you know. And obviously, 2 years later, the Portsmouth Spartans left small town Ohio and became the Detroit Lions. So, you know, so when you talk about Lions history, those first 4 years were actually in Portsmouth. So they have a little tie to this, what I always call the indoor game from 1932.
Yeah, somebody from my day job gave me, he was at the Portsmouth Stadium and took some photos of it and sent it to me. I was, oh, that's so cool. You know, that kind of, and it still says something like home of the original Lions, or I forgot what it says, something like that right on the placard there. So what we're going to do, I mean, we're going to get done talking about Detroit Lions controversies. I don't need to talk about that in Chicago and the Calvin Johnson rule. But what we'll do is we're going to give you this DeLorean. I don't know if you can see it in your screen here because I'm not frozen up. But we're going to take your first DeLorean trip with me. Peyton Manning alluded to this in his Peyton's Places, but that's another one of those stories you can't make up, right? So let's tell me about the famed brick wall defender, what that story was. Then I have a follow-up question after that.
I'm not a big fan of the brick wall story, so to speak, because I think it's been embellished, you know, and that was one of the reasons why, you know, writing the book, I a lot of times you see some of the same, you know, sort of stories that were repeated, and that was one of them, and like talking to Tony Nagurski also, you know, but I mean, it's a funny story, he carries a ball, what, 5 or 6 straight times. And then the last time he runs through the entire defense and he runs through the end zone, he hits the brick wall in the back of the end zone at Wrigley Field, and he almost gets knocked out. And he sort of comes to the sidelines and he just tells Hollis or whatever, "Oh, wow, that last guy hit me hard. Who was it?" And it was actually, the brick wall in Wrigley. So, but for the most part, Bronco never really told that story. It was more the sports writers, sort of repeating that, as a banquet thing. So,
well, yeah, it's a legend of the lore that builds upon it, and especially through time and everything. And one of my questions, kind of follow up, and maybe you already took care of that one. Mm-hmm. The other second follow up would have been like, through our history or research, is it something that truly happened, or was it something that maybe it was debunked because of maybe a Tony telling you or somebody like that?
You're talking about the Wrigley or the hitting the Wrigley
yeah,
wall?
I mean, the hitting the brick wall. Did he actually that? Go to the sideline, or
I don't think he actually did it. I mean, it was more of a like kind of story to show how strong he was and how dominant he could be. Now, I didn't find in quotes, like, Bronco would maybe just play that up a little bit, and because he knew it was kind of a funny banquet story. The other one that, that sort of can be debunked is the other one where Bronco is being recruited to go to the University of Minnesota, how the coach at Minnesota, Doc Spears, found him, where he was driving, he's trying to recruit a player in that region, and he stops and he sees to get directions to find it, and he sees Bronco plowing the field with no plow or no horse. He's just got the plow, and he's like, "Do you know where, I'm looking for, the player's Jim Smith?" And Bronco picks up the plow by himself and points his direction with, this massive 1,000-pound. And he's like, "Well, I want you instead." Well, that never happened either, because I found several quotes that Bronco would say, "Oh, no, that's not how I got to Minnesota." He would say, "Oh, no, Doc just made that up." So, so those things, just like the Paul Bunyan thing, it's part of his lore and his persona, but sometimes probably not quite as accurate as you would like.
And that's a good kind of thought into, as just historians in general, going back and truly trying to get the facts of the matter. I mean, there's a story, the lore that tells us, and it's a reason why maybe you get a lot of fans to follow. But I think even I'd have to listen to my episode, I might have actually told that story that way, as it was a matter of factly versus just, "Hey, this might have happened" kind of deal. And that's how, it's just funny how things can go as you learn more throughout the time kind of deal. So let's do that then. Let's stay back here in time, because I want to get to maybe some of your favorite stories. We don't want to give away the whole book by any means, but you can keep the keys to the DeLorean. Maybe go back to 2 or 3 different pivotal key moments, your favorite stories, maybe stuff that's been uncovered you never heard before from Tony, whatever it is. Like, give me 2 to 3 of your favorite stories about Bronco Nagurski.
Yeah, I mean, when you do some of these type of research and you try to find obviously you want to tell the best stuff and you want to tell the best story, but there's always some good ones. I mean, I think the one thing that I try to find, because you just don't want to be repetitive through game recaps, is to try to find as much as you can, him as a player from his opponents and from his teammates, so those are always key to try to find, because you can always go and look up a box score or say, "Okay, he scored 2 touchdowns in this game, so he must have had a great game in that game," but what you want to find is a little bit more of those stories, like, found a little bit more of some interviews with him in, throughout the 30s where he talks about preparing for games, you know, whether, you know, he's being interviewed at his locker and he's telling like, oh, well, we think we can beat the Packers this week because we can do this, you know? So those sort of more, a little more personal, or like the other things is trying to find what opponents, especially what opponents said about Bronco. And that was one thing that I found a lot was you just couldn't ignore how many, especially opponents and teammates, like, praised, you know, Bronco for his play, you know, so it just wasn't one guy, or like you said, you get a lot of the teammates, but you know, you're not finding what opponents say, but there was guys like Benny Friedman and Clark Kinkle, obviously he had the big relationship. And that was one thing that was nice to find was, you know, him and Clark Kinkle, the Packers fullback, they went at it, you know, there's a big famous hit that, you know, that Clark Kinkle knocked Bronco out. It was like the one time the Bronco ever got knocked out of a game was Clark Kinkle. And you see it in the Green Bay Press Gazette. It says, you know, Hinkle off left tackle breaks through, gets 1 yard, you know, tackled by Nagurski. Nagurski leaves game because of broken nose, you know, so he got knocked out. He got his nose broken from Clark Kinkle. And that actually turned out to be a good thing because they actually became pretty close friends. You know, I talked to Tony and he had some stories about how Clark and they would get together. And I found some articles even like in the 60s and 70s, like they would get together and go play golf, you know, in Ohio where Hinkle lived, or there was a Pro Football Hall of Fame type of event in New York. I think in like 1966, maybe, or 64. And they got together and they went to a Giants Browns game, you know, and you say, oh, wow. You know, so they actually became friends. And there's actually a photo in the book of them together that's Clark signed to Bronco, like, oh, my good pal Bronco. And it's signed by Clark Kinkle that the family has kept, you know, for years. So those are type of stories that you find that make it unique and make it a little bit more personal, that you get to know them a little bit better than the stats. And, you know, yeah, the stats are neat to find, you know, and the scores and things like that. But it fills out some of these chapters to find those type a little more personal things.
Yeah. I mean, that's the stuff that we want to know too, is just the person in general and all the other stories that you don't get to, like the stories you don't ever hear from the, like you said, even the brick wall, it's like, that's been played over and over, but we get to hear these other ones. And you mentioned some photos from the families. That mean that there may be some photos in here that a reader would, first time they could ever see this type of photo then?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that was one of the fortunate things to be able to go through, you know, through the family. They sent me a lot, you know, all their family photos and, you know, and it was pretty much entire life. It wasn't just, oh, I just want to look at the football stuff. It was, like you said, that Hinkle Nagurski photo was, you know, at the Hall of Fame, I think in 1964, you know, when Hinkle went in, Bronco was his presenter, you know, so that wasn't even during their playing, but it's a really nice photo. It shows how their friendship was and things like that. So there was a lot of that to be able to look through and to be able to use, you know, so pretty much like all the photos within the books came from the families, and the majority of them, like I said, have never been published or seen before.
Beyond just like that, you know, going back through and maybe talking to Tony, do you have any other interviews with former players that maybe were, I guess, I don't know if they'd be old enough now, the timing, but were there any of them that would have been able to play against them, or are they all too old now?
That's the unfortunate thing was, you know, starting, cause I started this project in 2020. By then pretty much all the Bears players from the 30s and 40s have all passed away, you know? So, I was fortunate to lean back. In my time, you know, with other projects, you know, and here at Films, was I was able to interview a few of his ex-teammates before they passed away. In 1999, I was able to interview George Musso, who was a lineman who was in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, you know, as a guard, tackle. You know, then Charles Uki Miller was a center on those early 30s teams. He was still living. And Hamp Poole played with them in 1943. So there were some that I was at least to be able to lean on some archival interviews that at least, you know, when I interviewed him, I asked about Bronco and they gave me some Bronco stories, you know, same thing with the Red Grange. They were able to talk a little bit about Red Grange at the same time, you know? It's just unfortunate that generation, especially 20s, 30s and 40s, are all pretty much gone. And even the 50s now, there's not as many players are still living, you know, from those eras. So that part of it, I didn't quite get into as much as I would like, but I was able to lean on some of the things that I was interviewed, you know, before they had passed away with some former players and same thing with opponents. You know, I interviewed Harry Newman around the same time, Glenn Presnell, who played for the Portsmouth Spartans in that indoor game. I was able to interview them before they passed away, and they gave me some Bronco answers too.
You just mentioned NFL films, and that I know that was after he would have been around, but what about footage of Nagurski? How much footage you think is actually out there?
Yeah, that's another thing that, we talked about the fire with the Bears. The footage from the 20s and 30s is a little bit more scarce than I would like, you know. I think we have like 6 or 7 Bears games from when Bronco played, you know, a few from 43 when he came back, you know, played tackle during the war. But there's a few from like 36, 37. Some Lions. So there's some footage. There's not a lot. There's some from the sneaker game, you know, that exists, not the entire game. So you just kind of try to put those bits and pieces together to try to find as much as you can film wise. But it's unfortunate that we don't have as big archives as we have of like Joe Montana and Barry Sanders and Jerry Rice. We have their entire game. We have every single game they played. We have a TV broadcast. We have the NFL film stuff. But the 20s, 30s, and 40s, like, you know, it's a little bit more limited, especially the 20s and 30s, a little more limited than even a post, you know, Super Bowl era, so to speak.
Yeah, part of me always wonders, too, if there was more availability and it was able to be more footage shown, some of the lost in time, forgotten players. You know, the Bronco Nagurskis, Red Granges, maybe they stand the test of time, but some of these other players that are well worthy of being in the Hall of Fame that hadn't made it in. And if we had access nowadays, I wonder if they'd have a better shot at it.
Oh, absolutely. I do feel bad a little bit for some of those, especially now that you've seen some more movement of senior candidates for the Hall and even try to, get more publicity for some of these earlier players, that if there is more visual, then maybe we got a better chance at evaluating them a little bit more than some of the other, you know, you try to do as best you can, you know, through there, some of the research, whether it's through microfilm, through interview, oral history, testimonials from players, but visually see a little bit more, you know, would be nice, you know, especially the 20s and 30s. Cause like I said, there's very few footage that have survived.
Oh, so we get to play a game now. I was going to do this in a different light, but maybe we can change up the story. The new Madden's going to come out like a vintage with John Madden busting through the brick wall or whatever it is. And I was thinking about, okay, Bronco, he would have been a good one, you know, for all time greats, you know, looking back at it. So maybe we'll play a game of Mount Rushmore. Pick your top 4 player, coaches, contributors in NFL history that could be on the Madden for a throwback edition that you'd like to put on there that maybe don't get enough recognition.
Okay, so explain that again to me. So my Mount Rushmore of like...
It's going
to
be, yeah, you pick 4 player, coaches, contributors, but we're going to change the rules because I'm going to say of the players that you think maybe should be given more credit that could potentially be in the Hall of Fame that maybe not many, the regular fan doesn't know about.
So these are, they're not in the Hall of Fame?
Correct.
Okay. So, cause this has been talked about a little bit, I guess now with, you know, cause they have the 12 super seniors. There's 2, I think they're head and shoulders above everybody else in my mind. That's not in the Hall of Fame, that I think should get. And one is, Vern Llewellyn. He's a Packers halfback. I talked to Cliff Crystal. He's the Packers historian. He's actually a former Hall of Fame voter, and he's a sports writer for 40 years, but now he's the official historian for the Green Bay Packers. And he thinks Vern Llewellyn actually has a case of being maybe the greatest Packer of all time, not just in the Hall of Fame. He's up there with Don Hutson and Brett Favre and Bart Starr, like one of the 2 or 3 names that's the greatest of all time. And I almost lean to agree. I think he's a member. Not only does he have, he's got like 5 first team all pros, you know, he's got scoring, and he was a member of the Packers' first three championship teams. They won championships in 1929, 30, and 31, and they were the first NFL team to win three straight. So just looking at that, you're saying, well, that's Hall of Fame worthy. You know, if he's the best player on the team that won three straight NFL championships, you know, and the players say that. Johnny Blood McNally and Cal Hubbard all say he was the best of us, but they've all been in for, you know, Hubbard and McNally went in with the first class, you know. And so to me, for Llewellyn, and the thing that pushes over the top for me for Llewellyn is I believe there's 23 Hall of Fame backs from the 2A era. So that includes like Grange, Fritz Pollard, Ken Strong, like there's 23 backs. So it's either a fullback, halfback, or quarterback. And he is the all-time leader in touchdowns scored. He scored 51 touchdowns during that era, and nobody's better than him. Like all the backs that are in the Hall of Fame, and you got to remember, this is an era when scoring and field position were the most two most important things. You know, it wasn't passing stats or pass. You know, it was scoring and field position. He was the best punter in the league until Sammy Ball came along, and he scored the most touchdowns until Don Hutson came along. And everybody thinks Don Hutson might be the best of the 2A era players too. You know, it's like. So I think Vern Llewellyn for me is number one. And number two would be Ox Emerson. You know, he's a former Portsmouth Spartan, Detroit Lion. He's another guy it's like five, six first team all pros. You know, he's an all decade player. He was on a member of the Lions' first NFL championship team in 1935 with Dutch Clark. And he blocked for Dutch Clark, who actually made the NFL's 100th anniversary team, you know, like another one that has a resume that says he's a Pro Football Hall of Famer, but doesn't get noticed, you know? So those would be the first two names for me, you know, right off the bat. You know, I would think the other two names, if you're talking players, coaching contributors, I think the other one actually you'll probably like this because he's another Lions tie. Is Buddy Parker, the head coach, you know, here's a guy that has a tremendous record, you know, above 500 winning percentage, you know, he took the Lions to two NFL championship wins. And the most impressive of that is that he beat Paul Brown twice. You know, he wasn't beating Schmoes, and he beat Paul Brown twice in championship games. And then he leaves Detroit and he goes to Pittsburgh, and he actually leads the Steelers, who were terrible for 25 years, to actually one of their first playoff berths, you know, and they had a chance to win a playoff game. And to me, he's been overlooked for many years. And then when they had the centennial class, he was one of the finest, but he did not get in. So he would be up there too, I think, for the guys that aren't in the, and then the fourth, it had to be from this era, or can it be from any era, or just
any era you wish? Okay, you had the keys.
Who's kind of by, because I always liked the early era. So, but I want to give a little love to maybe a little more modern player, but he's not on the 12, which I don't understand, is Roger Craig, the old 49ers. He played for the Vikings and the Raiders too. But here's a guy that actually would be one of the most dominant players in football today, you know, because this is what the league is looking for, especially the last 20 years, was a dual threat guy that can run the ball, can catch, and can block. Like, but Craig was doing it a little bit before the norm. You know, he was doing it in 83, 84. I mean, obviously, you know, in 85, he's the first guy to run for 1,000 and, you know, pass receive for 1,000. He's the first 1,000 guy. I mean, he wins three Super Bowls with the Niners. He's got, he doesn't quite maybe have as many all pros because, you know, you had Dickerson, you had Walter Payton, you had, you know, the end of Dorsett, you know, and you had a lot of these great players, and he had many Pro Bowls. But to me, he's a guy that sort of set the standard for the Marshall Faulks, the LaDainian Tomlinsons, the Le'Veon Bells, the guys that now that a lot of teams are looking for, who can run and catch and do all these multiple things. Well, Craig was doing that, you know, almost, you know, 15 years before these guys, and was doing it at a high level. And I thought he'd be under the radar a little bit too. So I'll put him up there too on as my fourth.
Yeah. I mean, again, you get there, and I've seen a lot of chatter about recently the whole what they, a lot of people feel a snub for Roger Craig. The later days back in the, I don't hear that as much because not as many people are educated, but geez, you're only talking within my lifetime for Roger Craig kind of deal. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's, and like I said, he sort of should be in the wheelhouse of getting that more of that tension, you know, or at least being discussed. He doesn't necessarily, you know, whether he gets in or not, that's up to the vote, but I think he should be getting discussed a little bit more or being on these sort of finalist lists.
So speaking of notoriety or whatever term we want to put to it, Nagurski was huge as far as wrestling goes back then too. Was he more, air quotes, famous for wrestling than football, or was that not true?
Well, I think you can say the football led to his wrestling career, you know, so I think they were, because at that time, wrestling was just as popular as the NFL, you know, somewhat coming into the 30s and into 1940. But I think it sort of led to, you know, one led to the other. Like I don't know if he could have done the wrestling quite at the level, especially popularity and the world championship, if he wasn't as well known as a football player. So I think him being an All-American, him joining the Bears and getting, you know, all pro and being even more, because his first year he wrestled was 1933. So he had already played 4 years or almost 4 years of NFL before he really started wrestling, you know, because it took him a couple of years. And that's where 1937 is a huge year. I think it's one of the most impressive sort of sporting achievements is in 1937, he not only is playing for the Bears, but he also wins the world championship of heavyweight wrestling. In the fall of that year, he is defending his title in wrestling while also playing pretty much on Sundays with the Bears. So there's, you know, the book describes this in more detail is, so he would like wrestle on he would wrestle like sometimes on Tuesday in Seattle. He would do Thursday in Portland. Then he would fly back to Chicago on Saturday, play the Bears on a Sunday game, and then maybe on Monday fly to, you know, Houston to wrestle. Like he did this multiple times, especially in August and September and a little bit into October. He did that several weeks, and then eventually Hal said, "We need you here." So he took a lot of November off right before and then they made the championship game against Reds. And then he would take, and that was the thing that sort of drove him away from the NFL was being the world champion. He had these responsibilities and he had these big gigs that he could make five times as much money wrestling than he did with his NFL contract, you know. So eventually it came to head in 1938 and he decided to just wrestle because he could make more money being the heavyweight champion than he would. Although he loved football and he wanted to keep playing, he's like, look, it just does me no good to commit to you for, you know, 35. He was making 3,500, I think, at that time, you know, down from the 5,000 he made his rookie year. And, you know, he was already being away from his family anyway. So he was like, you know what? You know, I'm just going to wrestle and just, you know, make that commitment and things like that. So, but that year, 1937, when he was doing both, it was just a tremendous achievement because you could look at the dates and you're like, well, he's wrestling three times in this week. He's playing the Bears. Then he's wrestling two more times. Then he's playing with the Bears. And then it just like he's all, and like I said, he's not just wrestling in Chicago and Milwaukee and St. Louis. I mean, he's going out to the West Coast. I mean, he's wrestling in Los Angeles. He's Portland, Utah. Like he's all over the country, you know, traveling while, you know, the Bears are trying to win a championship in 1937.
Yeah. I mean, just nowadays you couldn't really, you'd have to be there for practices. I know like the Deion Sanders, the Bo Jackson, there's like a few of them here and there, but I just can't imagine. I mean, did they have commercial flights back in 37, or was he doing like a private plane, or how was he getting around?
No, I think it was a little bit more commercial. I think it was just, you know, the family didn't know the details of that, but it was more, I think, just, you know, especially the West Coast, it would just be a commercial flight. Sometimes he might have just took the train, you know, to some spots, you know, but I think it was just a commercial flight. Maybe there's, you know, one a day to Los Angeles and that's the one he's taking. And then he comes back the next day, you know, or the day after and stuff. So, but my guess, it was not any type of private planes. It was more, hey, I'm going to take the one flight. I can get one flight to Los Angeles. And that's why that day is why they're wrestling, because there's one flight out to Los Angeles from Chicago or from the Midwest.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess my history, I was trying to think, I'm like, wow, they really had commercial flights back then. But then, yeah, they had some planes in World War One trying to figure out how to get off of aircraft carriers. World War Two, they kind of had it figured out. But I thought commercialized was more like after World War Two in the 50s or something like that. Or maybe that's just when it became more popular.
I believe so. Yeah.
I know, because like it happened during COVID or maybe beforehand, did you ever make it out to that Bronco-Nagurski Museum or no?
I did not. I got footage from it. And I mean, Tony has been there. I mean, the family's been there many times. You know, they actually still live in there. So that was the unfortunate thing. I wasn't able to get there during COVID. And then I had to turn the manuscript in at the end of 21 or, you know, October. So I was not able to do that. So that was the only unfortunate thing. So, but I have seen their displays. I've seen video of the museum and things like that. So, because yeah, International Falls is not easy to get to. If you look,
I was gonna
at
say
it
you're
map,
basically Canada.
it's you could fly into like Minneapolis, but then it's like 4 hour drive. Like it's not easy to get to. And I believe there's like one flight, almost like the 1940s. There's like one flight from Minneapolis to International Falls every day. So if there's weather, which there's, or some bad, like there's one flight there and there's a, like, I think it's in the morning and I think there's a return flight in the afternoon. So if you plan there, you know, a lot of times I don't know if that flight even takes off. I mean, if there's, you know, especially if you're going where there's some type of weather or winter, you might be delayed and you not, might get, you know, then you're driving 4 hour, you know, and so it's not the easiest turnaround, like, oh, I can just quickly go there and then come back or just spend a weekend there. And, you know, so it's unfortunate COVID kind of killed that for me.
But either way, we'll still give some love to the museum. So if any listeners of the show are in International Falls area, you take a trip, head out there, take a look at it. I've never been myself. I've just been on the website. So is that the family that operates out, or because you said Tony has been there?
Well, no, Tony, what happened was, I can give you a little background about that. The International Falls has always wanted to do something with Bronco. He just would not, just because his personality is shy. He's like, I don't need, no. So it wasn't until he passed away in 1990 that the family then looked into maybe doing something. And what they wanted to do was preserve his history and his story. So they thought the museum would be the best way to do it. So International Falls actually helped, I believe, raise money. They raised money to build it. So it was pretty much like donations, you know, and then the family agreed to allow them to do it. And so, because it's part of the county museum, and you see, I think it's Bronco and Cucuchinga County, I think is what it's in. And so it's the Bronco Museum and the county museum, and it's all in one sort of big building, but they actually raised money to help build it. And then that's how it operated. I think it opened in 1993, if I'm correct. Around that time is when it officially opened. So,
okay. Yeah. Cause I seen in their website, and I mean, I'd have to vet it out, but it said something like the only museum to a single athlete or something like that. And I don't know if it said United States or the world, but yeah, I mean, dedicated to them. But it, like you said, it's kind of like a museum within a museum, it sounds like more.
Yeah. I mean, the Bronco is separate. Like I think, you know, there's the county part of it too, you know, but within it, it's a Bronco-Nagurski Museum. You see, there's like a big statue out front and they have a whole huge display and you can go in there and you can visit and look at it. I think there's like a 12-minute video, you know, and things like that. So it's a pretty neat, I think, environment, like I said, for an individual. So you just don't see too many individual type of things like that. Even for athletes, you know, as well known as athletes can be, and people love this, you know, especially for a football player, it's like I said, it's one of the more unique museums.
Oh yeah. Especially player from the 30s. I mean, yep, that's to have a museum nowadays. So speaking of the player from 30s, and now we're immortalizing his name, I guess, through paperback and even through possibly audio down the road. What is the name of the book again, and where can the listener of the show go to get it?
Sure. It's called A Bronco, The Legendary Story of the NFL's Greatest Two-Way Fullback. It's published by Rowan and Littlefield. And it's out, you know, pretty much right now. You can order it on Amazon, you know, Barnes and Nobles. And the publisher's website is rowan.com, R-O-W-M-A-N.com, Rowan. So it's available, and you know, hopefully, you know, we'll start getting some response of you know, people reading it and stuff. So, Bronco, the legendary story of the NFL's greatest two-way fullback.
And we'll have links in the show notes as well as when we get on the website. I don't know if I told you, but if you remembered, you went back in time on the DeLorean, but we never brought you back. And sorry to say, but Grandpa Biff followed you, and he's just hijacked your DeLorean, so you're stuck back in the 30s. You know, the heyday, the prime of Bronco Nagurski. You have two options. You can get the keys back. Yeah, but it's like you're either going to line up against Nagurski with the lack of pads and protection they had back then and try to tackle him, or is your other option you can stay there? Which one are you taking?
Well, I mean, for me, if you know my background in person, you know, I would stay in the Stone Age. That's where I love to be. So I wouldn't mind. And that's the thing. Nowadays, like when I was in high school and in college, when I played, I was like a 165-pound wide receiver. Well, back in 1930, that actually would be an okay running back at 165 pounds. So I'll stay in the 1930s, and I'll take my chances against Bronco. I'll probably get ran over, but I'll take my chances against Bronco.
Who knows? Maybe you could try out for the Cardinals or something like that, and you can make your face name. We'll have a book for you down the road in the 2022 era. But with that being said, last words of wisdom. Any last words of wisdom? NFL wisdom, Bronco Nagurski wisdom, NFL films, whatever it is for the listener of the show.
I think the best thing about Bronco, like I said, we didn't get a little bit into, he was one of the first few players to sort of do the coin toss at the Super Bowl. So it sort of came full circle for him. And, you know, I think that's the one thing about these projects that's great is as much as, you know, I love and you love the NFL now. You know, we plan our, you know, our falls around the games. You know, same thing with Bronco. Like, you know, he played when, you know, he got, you know, $150 a game in front of 5,000 fans. And then when he flipped the coin, there was what, 80,000 fans in a sold out stadium at the Super Bowl where, you know, at that time was probably like 80 million people watching or 75. But by that time, that was a ton of people watching. And so I think Bronco stories, maybe like all of us, you know, we sort of go full circle in how we enjoy the game. And that's a good thing. You know, I love, you know, like I said, we all love football. We all love stories. We love reading about it. We love the history. We love watching on Saturday, you know, on Sundays and watch on Monday nights and Thursday nights now. So I think that's the one thing I'll wrap up is just, you know what, this is, everything sort of sometimes goes full circle and how we enjoy the game and how it's become so popular.
Again, if a better football name exists out there than the legendary Bronco Nagurski, I don't think I found it yet. Maybe on some other planet there is, and aliens will come down. They'll come to us with the new football name they got from the football gods up in the heavens. But for now, I'm going to go ahead and put my stamp on it. Bronco Nagurski. Best football name in the world. But besides that, I hope you enjoyed this episode. It's an interview with Chris Willis, and I gotta imagine you already paused it, right? You went and picked up a copy of Chris's book over on Amazon or Barnes Nobles or wherever else you get books at. Again, the book, Bronco Nagurski, Legendary Story of the NFL's Greatest Two-Way Fullback. Speaking of enjoying this interview, if you enjoyed this show in general, please leave a rating and review so I can learn what I can do better. And of course, you know you gotta mash that little subscribe button, your podcast player choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest out the press episodes, well, each and every week. Night. Even if you got me locked in already as a subscriber, follow the show. What you do is subscribing to the show kind of helps a little bit with the rankings. I don't know how this whole algorithm thing works out, but I've been told that if somebody listens to my show and they subscribe to it, they follow to it, somehow I get higher in the rankings. So. Bam, boom. Win-win situation for us both. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Podcast Network.